Hello and welcome to the new Slicker Two Tones. We've chosen the right theme music. Yeah. We've got all the correct microphones turned up and you are listening to the show that has followed the fill-in there for Spoke, which had David on again, Mary Jane Fenwick pressing the buttons, and Kath Devaney in studio. Great show, guys.
So that was the Banana Lounge broadcasting theme.
That was it. We found the right music. Mary Jane Fenwick did. Mm. And so far, we've had just all the connections, all the chords that last week were just kicking around the place as hazards for people to trip over. This week, we've plugged them all in we're ready to go.
A bit misleading, though, because to me, it sounds like, Dave and Elizabeth are coming on. I mean, we should really have our own theme music for these fill-in slots, I feel.
What would be a good theme track? I've got Dennis Waterman's I Could Be So Good To You.
Would that have ever have been heard on Triple R, do you think?
Phoebe Squared plays it a little bit. She's
really?
A fan of that opening montage.
I see.
The work on the pier that was done on Minder.
Well, okay, we've got a short list of one, the theme from Minder.
I've also got any number of Scott Joplin tracks if you want to get that 1910s feel.
Okay, no? I hadn't considered a 1910s feel.
Well, we are. I think we're two tones, right?
Yeah.
This is how far I'm thinking. Mm. That because our shoes represent that gangster era that is represented in the Sting, name of our show, Two Tones.
So we're wearing spats.
It throws me back to that era. So although Scott Joplin's turn of the century, were they two-tone shoes there, or is it more 1920s, 30s with where they chose the wrong era of music in the Sting anyway?
I'm not sure. The Sting was part of a 70s version of the 1920s, wasn't it?
And they thought we wouldn't notice that the music was turn of the century, not 20s.
That's right. All the fonts were wrong. Everything was wrong. Okay, I don't know if we want a ragtime opening to the Two Tones.
You don't.
We need to drag ourselves into at least the latter half of the 20th century.
70s and beyond?
Mm. I think
Because we're so... You know how we've got that sense of cool, we both have keratoconus and we both have to wear large, dark sunglasses. Yeah, maybe we could go for some black exploitation music.
That's a bombshell to just drop on new listeners, isn't it?
What, that we've both got the same eye condition?
Welcome to the keratoconus hour. The pointiest eyeballs on radio.
It's true. We both have corneas. People, even my girlfriend, now my wife, she seems to forget what keratoconus. She asks me about every 4 weeks.
Oh, look,
what is it again?
I look it up on Wikipedia every year because I can never quite remember.
And I say, remember, I've got corneas that are shaped like crinkle cut chips. And so therefore I have to put hard contact lenses over the front and it forms a new sphere. The tears come in behind them.
See what you're doing?
Yeah.
Have you got contact lenses in
always,
now?
Always.
So in all the time I've known you, you've had contacts
in? Yeah, I can't see without contact lenses in.
Is that right?
I've got five congenital eye conditions.
Five?
Amblyopia.
Right.
Long-sightedness.
Yeah.
Astigmatism.
Yeah, I've got a bit of that.
Keratoconus.
Yeah.
And a squint.
And a squint, a Clive James squint. But I just explain it to people as being, I've got pointy eyes.
Well, yours might be pointy. Mine, I've had them tested. They're exactly the same shape as the mashed potato pyramid in Close Encounters of the Third Time kind.
Maybe that's a sign.
It could be. I'll follow them and then I'll see a spaceship. Or
it's interesting because I thought you couldn't have contact lenses if you had keratoconus because mine were it was like balancing a saucer on a pencil. They were too pointy.
Well, it depends. You've got to have the right sort of keratoconus because certainly you can't have soft contact lenses because what would happen? The soft contact lens would take the shape of the mashed potato pyramid out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and you would still be splitting the light in a non-spherical way. So you need to be able to balance your saucer on top of your pyramid.
And you'd be socially ostracised too in the keratoconus community.
Pretty much. But there's a group of us, the hard contact lens keratoconus people, who get around okay. I can't believe you strictly are not being corrected by glasses. Glasses do not correct keratoconus.
But they're correcting the thing you said earlier, the stigmatism.
Yeah, but you've just, you've in cricket terms, raised your bat and shouldered arms to keratoconus and said, that's too good for me. I can't do anything about it.
Have I? I don't know what that means. I do have to wear sunglasses a lot when I'm outside because the light refracts into me. If it's a really cloudy day, do you get this?
Yeah, I hate it out there in the cloudy
light. It's like
light.
Someone's got a bank of spotlights in your face, so then you have to have sunglasses, and then everyone just thinks you're up yourself.
And what do you think of driving at night where you see three cars coming at you? Do you get that?
Oh, I'm used to that. I do the maths.
Middle car?
That's right. Go for the middle one. I don't get that. What I get is if I go to a movie, like a Woody Allen movie, where there's white letters on a black screen in the credits, I see them twice. I see a ghostly second version underneath.
Can you tell me, speaking of credits and Woody Allen movies, because it's when there's so little to concentrate.
I've forgotten what that font is called, if you're about to ask me, but they stole it for The Invention of Lying.
Why are there two jobs in the credits where they give you a uni degree?
How
cinematographers always say ACE or something?
Yeah, ASC or ACS.
And then the casting people sometimes put their qualifications in as well.
Okay, I can understand that the cinematographer has had to get a degree.
Yeah.
But what is the casting degree?
Yeah, surely that is felicity from publicity, isn't it?
There'll be angry casting people calling in.
And publicity people. They'll all call in. And I should credit Philippa Overgaard, actually in the RRR office.
Right.
As far as I know, she invented felicity from publicity as an expression for publicists.
We've learned so much just in break one.
And offended so many people.
We don't even have a theme song. Hey, I've got some music for us. I thought let's have something from Brisbane. Do you want to have something from Brisbane?
Right.
Let's have a bit of Shaky Town from I Heart Hiroshima on Triple R. That'd be Shaky Town. It certainly would with the two tones here on Triple R. That's sounding good. See, I've got the right level now.
And they're out of Brisbane?
Yeah, they're out of Brisbane. They are indeed. Of course, I Heart Hiroshima being the band.
I saw a movie out of Brisbane 2 days ago.
What do you mean?
38 Shades.
Oh, is that the Nick Earls book?
I have no idea.
I think it might be.
It was like continuing to watch was like touching a kettle to see if it was still hot.
Oh, no.
Really? And it was one of those ones. I know that you've always been sensitive to the fact that you called your movie Bad Eggs, which it's like a big fat pitch to reviewers, isn't it?
It's like Michael Jackson calling his album Bad. Like a band calling themselves Wet, Wet, Wet. Well, it's a foolish idea.
Well, 38 Shades, the titular conversation that was is a unbelievably annoying, nowhere near as good as any John Cusack movie from the 80s chat between a guy and a girl at the Botanic Gardens where he's talking about there being 38 shades of brown.
Right.
So it's 38 shades of brown is the extended title.
I think that's the name of the book, but they've left Of Brown off the title of the film.
Well, 38 shades of brown would have been the sort of fat pitch that a reviewer needed for this film because the shade of brown they left out also begins with shit.
Oh no, really, that bad?
Shocking.
But I
shocking.
Heard it was that part of our vintage year for Australian film that I keep reading about.
Is that wouldn't be this year if it made free-to-air television. It may have been on Go. Possible it was on Go.
Hey, that's the 38 Shades. That is an interesting thing you're talking about. John Waters, the filmmaker who's coming out here I think in the next month, he's obsessed with the moment in a movie when someone has the line of dialogue that contains the name of the film. And there's always a certain self-consciousness in the actor's performance when they hit that scene because they know that's going
to
be
It
has to be the one. I'm afraid
big bell's going off as the line said.
That's right. I'm afraid we will always be from here to eternity. You know, someone always has that line. It's great.
That would make you the Godfather.
This is another case of double indemnity. There's always a certain portentousness when people have that line and they try and sneak it in, try and do it casual, throwaway sometimes.
Now, I read on Twitter where you were promoting the two tones this morning.
Now, just for people who, because people are calling in, they're confused because we don't use our normal names, sorry, because there are 1,000 Tony Martins and Tony Wilsons on Twitter. So I'm using the name of the website I write for, Scrivener's Fancy, one word, Scrivener's Fancy, leave out the apostrophe. For Twitter, and you are?
Tinseltone, and uppercase those two T's.
Right, because there's another Tinseltone?
I don't think so. You still find it?
Explain again why you were Tinseltone.
Because I was the Hollywood Reporter in my time on Breakfasters.
Oh,
and
right.
did a,
of course you
did
were.
Did an incredibly bad job.
Really?
I was never really on top of how many kids Brad and Angelina had adopted. I was never all that clear. Just even out there at the moment, Jess McGuire is sitting in the green room. And I said, aren't Jordan and Peter Andre back together?
No,
and she said,
no,
they're not.
How did you ever, as Tinseltone, did you ever announce somebody to be dead when they weren't sort of Richard Wilkins style?
No, but I determinedly refused to believe that Hansi Cronje was dead. Do you know who he is?
No, it's sports, isn't it?
He was the captain of South Africa and was disgraced.
It's a good name, isn't
in
it?
In a betting scandal. He's called Hansi Cronje.
Hansi Cronje.
Went down in a plane.
Right.
And Fee said, well, he's dead. It's sad. Mm. I mean, it's a sad situation where Hansi died with that sort of weight hanging over him. And I said, he's not dead. I would have heard if Hansi Cronje was dead. It coincided with two weeks I took holidays. So I read the news and thought I could not have missed Hansi Cronje dying. And you go on holiday, you just miss it.
Right.
And so I tried to resurrect, breathe life into the still corpse of Hansi.
Is Hansi on Twitter, though, because that's a craze I've noticed on Twitter, which is adopting the persona of someone who's dead. For example, Dom DeLuise, he's on Twitter.
And you've launched a campaign to up his followers.
I just felt it was a bit sad. Sam Pang was poking me with a stick saying, get some more, you know, support behind Dom. Frank Sinatra, there's a number of competing Frank Sinatras on Twitter. I think the best one is just Frank Sinatra, capital F, capital S. And he just occasionally, every few days, he'll just put up, hello to everyone down at Chili's.
Well, the only thing I think I've really come up with, I was really pleased with the line, how good would Oscar Wilde have been at Twitter?
Oh, right.
And then it's almost the only time anyone's bounced back at me, and they said, well, you can follow him over there. And someone's doing Oscar Wilde quotes every couple of days.
It's funny, isn't it, what people like on Twitter? Like, because I spent ages finding elaborate links to things and going, people love this. And then I just put up the dumbest joke I've ever thought of. I just put up, what was it? Stolen Auschwitz sign never existed, claims David Irving.
Funny.
And that's been my most popular tweet. Okay, what about that great link to those album covers? Nothing. But it's funny that I'm slowly working out the politics of Twitter. You can over-tweet people. So when I started, I was just going, hey, have a look at this. What about this? Check this out. And I realised I was like some annoying kid with ADD.
Because on the homepage, I only read about Kirstie Alley's weight loss projects. That's all that comes up for me now because she tweets every 7 minutes.
Oh, so you're following Kirstie Alley.
I am for a while.
Who's your favourite person to follow on Twitter?
You've put me on to a good one, a Chaz Licciardello, is that his name?
Licciardello. Licciardello. I would say the Chaz Licciardello is the king of Twitter, Australia at least, in terms of he just puts in the man hours, and he must just be on the computer all day because he's just constantly putting links up, really high quality links.
He's very good.
Yeah.
I'm still really an amateur hour for me.
Same here.
But the,
I didn't know what retweeting was until recently. See, I've been, you know, got to get with it. What about novelist Thomas Pynchon? Are you following him? He doesn't have a lot to say.
Does he?
No.
Well, he takes a long time to write a book, so I imagine it would take him a couple of weeks to even write a tweet.
Why did we bring this subject up? We brought it up because something was on there.
You said, this is because I was trying to do a one-second link to the topic that we've scheduled for this already lengthy talk break.
Yeah.
And that was burnt scrotums.
Oh, because, burnt scrotums.
Because in your tweet about the upcoming show, you said...
Yeah, I did promise.
Join us for good music, technical difficulties, and burnt scrotums.
All right, well, let's dangle that carrot before the listeners now. Let's have some burnt scrotum talk next and explain why. But first, some music from the new album from Flight of the Conchords. This is the title track from I Told You I Was Freaky.
Southern Culture on the Skids with Camel Walk. That's from their album, Dirt Track Date. And before that, Flight of the Conchords. Don't forget the silent H in it. Chords as in music.
Yes.
And the track name, Tone?
It was I Told You I Was Freaky from the new album. the title track. In fact, from the second series, which is out on DVD, in case you didn't see it on SBS, because a lot of people didn't realise it was the new series.
Well, there were two running concurrently. It was very confusing for people, because they were running the first series on one of the commercial stations, and so you'd say, you're watching Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah, it was on 10.
And they'd say, yeah, but I've seen it. And you say, no, well, not the one on SBS.
Yeah, that's right. Confusing. Very confusing. And there's not going to be any more now. That's going on at the moment with The Wire on the digital channels, isn't it?
Yes.
Because Channel 9 have been sitting on Series 5 of The Wire for about 2 years, which I think is the reason it's never come out on DVD here yet. I'm assuming it is.
And they've put that on Go, have they?
Well, they weren't playing it for ages. Again, you know, we've played the other series at 4 in the morning and nobody watched. What's the point? And now ABC have made Series 1, 2 and 3 of The Wire, big hits on
ABC 2.
ABC 2's caught on. It's finally caught on Saturday night. So 9 have gone, oh, we'll have a bit of that action. Let's just put Series 5 straight on to Go simultaneously, assuming, I guess, that people will just want to jump from Series 2 to Series 5.
Let's not give the ABC too much credit. They initially played the first two series thinking it was the next instalments of Wire in the Blood.
That's right.
But then it turned out all these people started saying, hasn't that improved? And someone said, everyone's writing in saying how much they're enjoying Wire in the Blood.
I would like to see, say, the Bunk from The Wire turn up in The Midsummer Murders and just say, get on with it.
You're talking to someone who hasn't seen The Wire. Right. We are ready to see it.
Now, what's going on there?
We've bought the I've bought the first four series because you've now taken to alerting me, almost like a pop up on your screen when JB have smashed their crazy prices.
It's sad, isn't it? Really?
Because you follow it like the stock exchange.
I do,
and you did tell me about that amazing deal where they were giving away it was $19 for a series, and there was a free series thrown in with any purchase of two or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was
you could get series 1 to 4 for $60 was the end result.
It was incredible. Mm. So I went and snapped that up, and I've since been badgering Tam to get underway with watching it.
And she's just selfishly
looking after children all night.
Right.
And when she finally finishes looking after children, you just say, do you want to watch a really hard-to-hear show where some people say you should watch it with subtitles turned on? And she says, oh, I wouldn't mind watching House of Elliot.
What's the House of Elliot?
That's a.
Is it about Tom Elliott?
No, it's set in the 1920s, so they could use.
Oh yeah,
they should use Scott Joplin music and be just 15 years out in terms of era.
I was once introduced to somebody who did the hats for House of Elliot. Isn't that great when you meet someone who did the hats for something?
And we've been trying to date, as in what? We're not trying to date. We've given up on that. Mm. But we've been trying to date when that series was released. And you've been the most helpful so far with a French and Saunders sketch in about series 2 or 3, you thought. So you put it around 94.
Yeah, probably.
And anyway, it's you've met someone who did the hats on the House of Elliot.
Yeah. This it doesn't go anywhere, that story, unfortunately.
My story does.
Yes.
So Tam, not knowing that we've got all four series of The Wire, what did she give me for Christmas? The Wire Series 1.
Oh, now that puts you in an awkward situation. What do you do there?
You point up to the top shelf of your CD.
Surely you don't. Surely you go, oh, that's fantastic, because I only have series 2 to 4.
We've been together 10 years,
okay,
Tony. You point straight to the shelves and you go, I got them for $60. How much do you pay? And she says $84 at Borders for one series.
Ouch! Burnt! What was she thinking?
She kept the receipt, so now it's effectively a voucher. It's a beautiful wire-packaged voucher.
What are you going to get?
Oh,
I would recommend Breaking Bad.
Well, I'm not going to go and get DVDs at Borders because I rely on you to bing up specials from that big yellow shop in town.
Yeah,
for DVDs. So I'll get DVDs there, but I've now got an $80 book voucher. I would call it.
Okay, books.
Now, so we sizzled scrotums.
Yeah, we certainly did, much like a certain footballer. What's going on there? Some NRL footballer, that's your Sydney brand of football.
And it's a guy called Carney, and I initially saw the headline and thought, oh, God, David Carney, one of my favourite Socceroos, has sizzled up someone's scrotum, because this is about a burnt ball sack.
Well, he set fire to someone's pants, and the end result, as all of the articles have taken some trouble to point out, is a burnt scrotum. The man is suffering from a singed scrotum. And it's not often that you see the word scrotum in the newspaper, so it leapt out at me.
Well, the word scrotum, it's amazing how all the actual anatomical words around the genitalia
yes.
are all awkward to say.
Mm.
So scrotum's awful. It's it's an awful-sounding word and an awful-looking thing. the other words that don't work very well are labia.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's not a very nice word to say, I don't think.
So you're saying scrotum is an example of...
Or is it labia?
Is it? there's our phone in. 55% say labia. What do you say? But is it... what's that word? Am I thinking of onomatopoeia?
Yes, you are thinking of that.
Is that when something sounds like what it is? Like...
Yeah. But it's more like bang.
Yeah, like bang.
Or rustle.
Or whiz.
Or whisper.
All right.
But...
Or scrotum.
Scrotum. Do you think it actually sounds like what it is?
It's certainly a good... It's a good choice. There must have been a meeting where they went, well, what are we going to go with?
Yeah.
One person would have
just... Do you know another ridiculous one that you don't get to say very often?
What's that?
Mons Venus.
No, that's true. I think is that the show after us, Mons Venus? Stick around for Mons Venus. What, in your day as a footballer, was scrotum singeing, on the cards? Or is this a recent development?
Well, the bad behaviour, the obsession with genitalia and the flashing around of genitalia is a universal thing that's happened through the eras at football clubs. And so I was at Hawthorn from 1989 to 1992, and there was some genitalia misadventures, but there was that I wouldn't say I ever saw fire. There was one very popular thing was to stick ice into people's underpants or shorts, like when they're not looking to.
During the game, that would be skillful. That would be impressive.
There's a current AFL league coach. I'm not sure where he played, but he is famous for his work with ice around balls.
Really?
And thereabouts.
Did you ever have to say that thing that you... I can't remember the exact wording of it, but you hear it on the news about every 3 or 4 days, which is, I'd like to apologise for the shame that I brought upon myself, the club, and football itself, something to those.
And the game in general.
And the game in general. Did you ever have to do one of those?
No, I... To be honest, I was, well, did I ever? No, I certainly never had to apologise. I was in the band of people who thought that genitalia should be kept pretty much to yourself.
Sure.
There was even a football trip I was on in the under-19s. This guy went on to play. I actually think he's the worst player to have ever played over 200 games for Hawthorn.
Really?
And he showed a budding interest in this laissez-faire attitude to throwing your chop around and just said, "Hey, Willow, have a look at this." And we were on a plane and he had his erection out plane.
That's unnecessary.
So that he was...
See, that's beyond,
what I'm saying.
That's no longer just fun to me.
As a young person, he's still in the underage. Like he's a developing player at that point.
Clearly.
He is on a fast track. He is on the monorail heading for, "I'd like to apologise for myself, for the shame I brought on myself."
Just standing in a press conference.
And the game.
A few inches back from the podium, apologising. Very poor.
See, but that's where it starts.
Mm.
And mind you, if had he been seen, that's where it would have ended as well. He would have been giving one of those apologies.
Yeah.
But I was very much an in-pants. I preferred to keep my own business to myself,
pretty much. And, of course, your dad being a footballer from an earlier era, he would have had... There wouldn't have been any of that sort of shenanigans in his day.
No, this is one of the great misapprehensions of football bad behaviour. What has changed, I think, is...
It gets into the papers.
Yeah, is the media coverage.
Right.
I think there was... looking at Dad, a non-drinker his whole life... a non-drinker his whole football life. He's on it now.
Right.
He would not have been, I don't think, party to those sorts of things. But there would have been a player in his era as well.
So scrotal etiquette would have been lax in those days as well. It's just that it wasn't as well publicised.
Exactly.
Right.
What the problem with the clubs are is that it's so many men together.
Yeah.
And people always want to lump that into homoeroticism, that this is about, you know, that someone showed an erection to me on a plane, so therefore that is
I can't see why they would,
so
Tony.
Therefore that is a come on.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I would, as a non-footballer, I would read it as one. If somebody came up to me on a plane and said, you know, cop this, I would assume that they were making some sort of unsubtle play.
But what you've
failed to identify
is that if you only spend time with men, apart from little windows of time where you rampantly try to sleep with women, your whole idea of what an erect penis is gets completely skewed.
Okay. I'm clearly looking at this from the wrong angle.
So was I. We've got a song, I think.
Have we got a song? Oh, here's what we're going to do, because it's a running thing here on the Two Tones, to play a UMI track, but to play a B-side, because they have so many good ones. Did I give it to you? It was track two on that CD.
Yes.
This is the B-side to What I Don't Know About You. It's called You Want It So Bad. Oh, thank you, UMI. You Want It So Bad. That's the B-side to the single What I Don't Know About You. You're with the Two Tones, Tony Martin and Tony Wilson, filling in for Dave Graney. And let me get it right, Elizabeth McCarthy, Banana Lounge Broadcasting. Normally in this time slot, they'll be back in 2 weeks from now.
How did you remember, can I ask? Because we did this last week where you had an Elizabeth MacArthur who did theatre with you in New Zealand.
That's right. Not only that, someone then pointed out to me later that Gina Riley played the character of Elizabeth MacArthur in the TV series Bly. So that makes it even sadder. Sorry about that.
I was trying to give you the clue. Think anti-communism.
I will.
And not sheep grazing.
I'll attempt to do that at all times, Tony. Who came in during the song?
Susie Morris Ashton, the person whose surname is most like a small English car in Australia.
Well, Susie has brought in something which she's discovered on Wikipedia. Now, a few people have pointed this out to me on one of my old shows. Ed Cavalier actually was mostly responsible for encouraging Wikipedia vandalism, which blew up in my face because my name was and my surname was Penis for about 6 weeks on Wikipedia as a result of that.
Do you still advocate it? Not so much.
I've been urged not to, but you know, it does occur. And Susie brought in this from Steve Guttenberg's page. Used to talk about Steve Guttenberg quite a bit on the radio, and this has been there on his page for, I think, over a year, uncorrected. This shows you how few people must visit Steve Guttenberg's page. Guttenberg has been rumoured to star as comedian Tony Martin in a movie adapted from Martin's upcoming book, A Nest of Occasionals. Now, it's long past the upcoming status, so that's how long that's been there. I love the idea. So people maybe think that's real. Someone's gone, is that vandalism? No. Who would say that if it wasn't true? And so it's just been left there.
Who would you cast as you in A Nest of Occasionals? As the young whippersnapper writing letters out of shells on the beach?
Well, you have to find a nerdy newcomer, probably, because it would be someone quite young.
5 years ago, would it have been Michael Cera? Or was it Sarah?
Oh, Michael Cera. That's a new... Because I'm a big fan of Michael Cera, but that style of acting that he does is becoming a cliche now. Who's that other one who's exactly like him, who's in the film Adventureland and now Zombieland? Is it Jesse Eisenberg or something like that? It's becoming the new sort of...
Is it the stammer nerd, insecure thing?
Girly man sort of acting. Somebody like that with glasses definitely would be playing me.
Is it? Do you think it's you know how that became a cliche, the four weddings and a funeral guy with that stammery. Is the Michael Cera the Hugh Grant for the younger generation?
Well, it's that thing where you go, he doesn't seem to have any other mode. But then, you know, did Cary Grant? So you know, people just get stuck in the one mode. It's like, it's as long as you don't have two people doing the same kind of acting in a scene. The one I always like to point out is in The Getaway with Alec Baldwin. Because Alec Baldwin used to have a normal voice, and then all of a sudden he started talking like this. And it's fine when you're the only person
talking like that
who does that. But then he, in The Getaway, he's in scenes with Michael Madsen, who's also doing that kind of acting. What do you mean we're not going to do it? Yes, we are. We're going to do it my way. And then you've got a third person in the scene who's just talking normally. It makes the other two sound ridiculous. Yeah, so I don't know. Actually, that would be good. Someone, maybe a tough guy actor. What do you mean that's Garamond? That's not a sans serif font, and you know it. Maybe a tough guy playing me would be the go. Lockie Hume wants to play me in any proposed. But there's, I should point out there is no suggestion that there is going to be a film.
But you would allow someone to make a film of it. Oh, well, no, you want to make it yourself.
Well, I just think that the matters canvassed in the books are too trivial to be realised dramatically, I would have thought, because there would have to be period reenactments, and yet it's essentially about nothing.
My dad changed rooms to read me the last line of your book.
What do you mean?
Like, he was reading your book, and then he said, "Ah, Tone, I just want to read you this." And I said, "Well, I did read it already," but he loved it. It was hysterics. He was laughing at the last line of your book.
The last line, which was just a complete fluke that I discovered.
It's another coincidence in your life full of coincidences that is very well chronicled in A Nest of Occasionals. But it's a particular, it's as though the family dysfunction that is very well told throughout the book, it comes to fruition in a little thing that happens.
But that was like a bad scene in a film where I was sitting there and I'd finished that bit, and I'm going, I just need a good ending. And I'd had this obituary for my grandfather sitting on my desk for ages, and I hadn't bothered to read it closely enough, and I just noted a mistake in the obituary, and that just gave me the ending, bang, like that.
It was beautiful.
But anyway, look.
I've been watching movies with Dad as well.
This is interesting. Now, this is because I'm fascinated by you and your dad's relationship. You quite appear, I have to say.
We look a bit the same. I'm 5 inches taller than him.
That's right. See, when I heard that he was a footballer prior to you, who, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, is slightly more successful.
Oh, much more. He played in the Premiership, and I played I played reserves.
I was assuming I was going to meet someone who's like twice as big as you. And, of course, he's a more compressed version of you.
Midfielder to my centre-half forward.
Right.
But he, we sometimes watch. And you found it odd that we'd sit down and watch a buddy film together.
Yeah, that's, well, it doesn't go on in our family. I'm assuming it's just normal behaviour.
Running Scared, 1986.
The Peter Hyams film with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
What was Gregory Hines in, Mr. IMDb?
He was a tap dancer. And there's if you want to go back through my Twitters on Scrivener's Fancy, you'll find a brilliant tap dancing scene with him and Steve Martin. But I think he's dead, Gregory Hines. Died about 5 years ago. He was in White Knights with Mikhail Baryshkinov, and he was in The Cotton Club playing...
So he was a dancer.
Yeah, he was a very good tap dancer.
Because it is heralded on the back of the DVD cover that this is the buddy flick of the decade.
Well, that's right, because I remember that was in the mid-80s. I remember when that came out, and it was very odd for a comedian and a tap dancer to be playing tough guy cops. And now... all comedians will play a tough, Adam Sandler in Bulletproof.
Yeah.
You know, Martin Lawrence. It's quite common now for comedians to suddenly just be a tough cop, I guess, since Beverly Hills Cop.
But it was odd. And this, I thought it was an odd film. I didn't love it, I must say.
All I remember is a car chase on some railway lines.
And it asks the question, why do the bad guys always get to drive the good cars?
What was the car?
That's on the back of the DVD
That's a draw car.
Now, you've asked the wrong person what was the car. It was a good car.
But you were telling me this is a film where...
I also saw Die Hard 2 in the same week, so...
Yeah. It hasn't aged very well, Die Hard 2.
I overdosed on good guys killing bad guys and being... I think that good people should have... some sort of moment of contemplation or even just reservation as they blow someone away.
Yeah, right.
So I find it odd people who need to punctuate each bullet piercing someone's chest as they writhe back and blood explodes out of their mouth.
Yeah.
I find people who need to get a one-liner out at that point Bruce Willis, yippee-ki-yay.
Yes.
Motherfucker, as a plane explodes.
Yeah.
But even these guys, they went into a... They shot L.A. Law guy.
Which one?
The Hispanic, president.
Jimmy Smits.
In the West Wing. Jimmy Smits.
Right.
Jose, he was playing.
Right.
They shot Jose and immediately... So Jose, bang, 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 bang. Immediately got into an argument as to who got him.
Oh, right.
I got him. No, I got him. And then, of course, he isn't dead.
He isn't dead, no.
And so they get into, I thought you said you got him. I thought you said you got him. And the overwhelming sense of fun as they're involved in bullet exchange,
yeah,
I found hard to take.
Well, see, that was kind of a new thing in the 80s.
One-liners after bullets.
Yeah, and there was...
Or was Clint Eastwood into that as well? But he did it with more gravitas.
Yeah, but his films weren't sort of comedic, or unless there was an orangutan sitting next to him in the cabin of his truck, perhaps they were. But there was, when I was a kid, there was a film called Freebie and the Bean with James Caan and Alan Arkin, which I remember as being quite funny, but it was got terrible reviews and it was considered disgraceful because it was the sort of behaviour that you're talking about. There was, they beat up a gay character and they make homophobic comments while they're doing it, and they're the heroes of the film. And it was quite shocking and very poorly received. And to this day, it's out on a very cheap DVD now. And if you look it up, it'll say offensive. And I had a look at it about 10 years ago, and you're going, what was all the fuss about? Because now everyone's an arsehole. All cops are arseholes now.
Yeah.
In movies, essentially.
And, we've had this debate before because I only ever saw the first three episodes of Dexter. But to me, that's the...
Oh, right, Dexter.
That's the final post where writers have gone, we've done an arsehole cop as a hero.
So you had a problem.
Then we've done, we've done wife beaters that sort of come good as heroes. What can we do? I know what we haven't done. We haven't done a serial killer.
Yeah, so you had a problem and you turned off Dexter.
I only did the first three eps, and you've tried to argue with me, or not argue, but suggest that I stick with it.
Because there is a storyline does emerge. It's not just that he's a wisecracking serial killer.
But even so... Even without the storyline, it still feels to me like they've deliberately trawled the bottom of the anti-hero bucket and look what's come up in the septic tank. We've got serial killers.
And you know what's happened?
Can we make a hero pedophile? That's probably the last one left, isn't it?
And, of course, in Dexter, sadly, Jimmy Smits cops it again. That seems to be the unifying theme.
Can you ever think of a... Oh, no. The protagonist pedophiles that you can turn into a hero figure, because that's effectively what I feel like they've tried to do in Dexter.
Well, I think you're being a tad harsh there. I mean, I understand. I felt the same sort of moral quandary in the first few episodes, but then I thought, well, that's part of the fun, or not the fun. I don't want to imply as in fun.
Blood spatters
in,
fun.
In the part of the way it plays with your mind. It says, okay, are you going to identify with this character? Why? And then later they go, well, here's his backstory. Maybe this explains it. See what you think of that. See what you like. See what you don't want to do with them apples.
Can I get Tam off House of Elliot?
Nah, she's not going to.
Watch?
She's not going to jump horses. But I'm sure there is a film that answers your earlier potentially tasteless question.
We need Happiness.
To play, we need to. Is that really?
That is one of the worst films ever made.
That's to me, what I found with Happiness is you're going, well, it's artily lit, but it's essentially a John Waters movie. Well, the dog comes in at the end and hello.
Screenwriter.
It's like a gag from Desperate Living.
The screenwriter has said, okay, let's do a bit of brainstorming around the room. Think of the shittest thing you can think of, all of you, okay? Postcard stuck to a wall with semen. Good. You're on the right track, Jono.
But I know what you say, but you're talking about the pedophile character in that film.
Yeah. Terrible. I watched Capturing the Freedmans last night. Did you watch that?
But that is an amazing bit of acting.
Couldn't
you
sleep.
Have to admit from that guy in that film.
In Happiness. Yeah, he's
Dylan
terrific.
Baker. Yeah. And what was the one you watched last night?
Capturing the Freedmans.
That's a documentary.
Yeah. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen it. I worry that it's going to remind
not
me too much of my family.
Could not sleep after that. I cannot work out what happened in that story.
Okay, so while Tam's looking after the kids, you're sitting there watching Happiness and Capturing the Friends. So what are you telling me?
We did play a song.
While she's watching House of Elliot. What a disturbing segment this has been. What have you got for us musically?
Did I put something on, or did you?
I don't. You're the one pushing the buttons today.
I think. Well,
I can hand you something if you'd like a piece of fine music. What about a bit of more New Zealand music? Would you like that?
We had that one already.
This
is the technical difficulty.
Take this.
I know what we were going to do.
What were we going to do, Tony? Something from the soundtrack of Happiness, perhaps?
No, we were going to do this.
Music to adhere postcards to a bedroom wall by?
Here we go. I think it's Jonathan Richmond. It may not be.
Thank you very much.
That's the Dave Graney Show from their self-titled album, The Dave Graney Show from 1998. Am I wearing something of yours? If you're wondering where Dave and Elizabeth are, they'll be back in 2 weeks' time. It's Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in here on Banana Lounge. So what were we talking about, Tony? We were talking about movies. There's a surprise.
We were.
Somebody just pointed out more vandalism, or possibly not, on Steve Guttenberg's page on Wikipedia. Listen to this. In 2011, Steve is scheduled to play a sex offender in the movie Mr. Tight Hands, written by Fred Savage. I don't know whether that's true, but it's on.
So that is, if it is true, and it ties into our earlier conversation about anti-heroes really plunging the depths.
Right.
And so a sex offender is right up there with a serial killer.
You yourself, now you mentioned you watched Running Scared, the 1980s buddy movie with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, but it doesn't stop there, does it, Tony Wilson? What else have you and your dad been watching?
This one I watched with Tam,
right,
and it was called Taking Care of Business.
Oh, Taking Care of Business with Jim Belushi and Charles Grodin, the great Charles Grodin, if I remember.
Well, in one of the reasons I looked to this film was that you've put me on to Charles Grodin in really one of the great buddy films of all time, which is
Midnight Run. Mm.
And so I thought, well, Charles Grodin's in this. I might have a look to see how it goes.
The trouble with Charles Grodin is there aren't many gems on the resume. There's The Heartbreak Kid, of course. That was a classic. And then his character in So You Married an Ex-Murderer.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real – it's not a long list of great Grodin moments, but I don't know that that's on there either.
The thing that was stunning about this film, and the I immediately wrote you an email about my thoughts, is that it is based on the Filer facts. It is about Charles Grodin plays a businessy type character who's got a big pitch meeting out of town, and his secretary fixes him up with a Filer fax. It's all the Filer fax is his life. Everything is written into this Filer fax. There are maps.
For younger people, well, what is a Filer fax?
They were like super diaries, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was like you'd have your calendar part of the diary, but you'd also have little plastic wallets where you could insert a key. And indeed, he had a key to the house that he was going to stay in out of town. You would also have a to-do list. It's everything that Microsoft Outlook now offers. So basically what we now do is we have Microsoft Outlook, and I'm sure just about every business person on the planet now would have a BlackBerry or an iPhone.
Right.
And they then plug those phones into their Outlook or their personal organizer on the computer, and all that information siphons across. But it was just great to watch a film that the entire premise of which is based on this out-of-date thing. It absolutely locks you into a four-year period between 1988 and 1992 when Filer faxes were going gangbusters.
See, sadly, I'm old enough and sad enough to remember that when Taking Care of Business was in production, it was actually called Filer Fax. They were going to call the movie Filer Fax.
So they dodged the bullet.
And we've just discovered on the IMDb that it was released in South Africa with the title Filer Fax. And we've also discovered on the IMDb that it was the very first writing credit of J.J. Abrams.
He kicked on too?
To do Alias and didn't he do the new Star Trek? I think that was him. Mission Impossible 3.
He's flying.
That was him. And Lost, I think it was him. But, yeah.
Okay. Call-in topic.
Call-in topic. Things that you don't see anymore in movies?
Things that are dated. Plot points in movies or big features of movies that are incredibly dated. It's technology in particular we're looking for that went by the wayside.
Okay, now a good example would be a few years ago there was that film with Colin Farrell called Phone Box, which came out, or Phone Booth.
There are so many films.
And when it came out, young people went, what is that he's standing in, that small room? How can they base a film around this?
There are so many films that couldn't be made now sensibly because of mobile phones.
Yeah, that's very true. Even from quite recently, from the 90s.
Well, you need the character not to be contactable and to have no way of contacting people out there.
What is the earliest film where you see a mobile... Because it is always... I know it's a cliché topic, but, you know, seeing how big the mobile phones get as you go backwards in time.
Well, everyone always mentions Wall Street, but check out Running Scared, people. That is a very large brick in the kidnapper's car.
There's somewhere that it's attached to a briefcase.
It's got the big cord. It's a genuine car phone in 1986 as well. It's not mobile. He finally lugs it up onto his shoulder to speak on it. It is huge.
I've been watching all the Matt Helm films with Dean Martin, and that was the era when no matter who the bad guy was, he could just push a button on his desk and a TV screen would pop up, and wherever Matt Helm was, he'd have not only a feed but multiple cameras, all shooting 35mm, covering it for him. So you go, how many cameras has he got? Helicopters? How many? What's going on?
9388-1027. That's the number. The topic is broad, to say the least.
Sure.
We're looking for technology that has gone by the by.
Someone pointed out to me the pull tab on the can of drink. That comes out.
Where do you see that?
In an old film. You don't see that anymore, do you? They've made it so that you can't detach.
They do the chit in two directions as opposed to the one that sliced your hand off as you were taking it out.
Something I like from really old movies is someone will faint and then someone will go and get the smelling salts. What the hell was that? Everyone seemed to have them.
There was, I think Scarlett O'Hara got on the salts pulled out.
Okay, so we want people to call up with...
I saw a Carol Burnett impression of Scarlett O'Hara last night on that
really?
Make 'em Laugh show. She was fantastic, Carol Burnett.
This is what you're watching while Tam's looking after the kids. You're veering from Carol Burnett.
We've got so many callers. Thank you. I was padding while we were finding callers. First caller, let's hope they're not just ringing up to find out what album of the week is. Hello, are you there? Have you got some outdated technology from movies?
Well, yes, I guess it's the development of technology. It was Get Smart, and of course his phone in the shoe. Now, I can't see any reason for having a phone in your shoe these days.
But it's almost like the first mobile phone, though, wasn't it? It's kind of a...
Well, it's quite, small, it was discreet.
A pioneering idea.
Apart from being secretive to the enemy... It's a little bit dated.
Didn't it have a dial?
It had a dial. It wasn't push button.
Obviously, there's an element of slapstick humour in there with the dial and the phone and the shoe.
And was it in the new film? Did they bother with the shoe phone?
Well, I think they would. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'm assuming they did.
And did they go push button? That's the question.
Probably. I saw it. It was very poor.
Better than the nude bomb or worse?
I would say worse than the nude bomb and possibly even worse than Get Smart Again.
Wow.
And nowadays a cone of silence means something completely different.
It certainly does.
Thank you. Who are we talking to?
Me.
Oh, thank you, me.
Thank you.
Let's check. We do have a couple of other callers.
Back in the cone, me.
Hello. Have you got some technology for us?
Yeah, it hasn't really got to do with technology, but just an outdated scene in... The Exorcist, the doctor comes out of the examining theatre and then looks at the mum and then lights up a cigarette in the middle of the corridor.
How funny is that? I think that was only in the re-release, the new version.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw that at the movies and it just brought the house down.
Yeah, I remember, I think I might have been in the same cinema because I remember everyone just pissing themselves at it.
Yeah, it's just, I saw the funniest thing in The Exorcist last night.
Well, again, running scared. I'm sorry I've only got one topic of conversation this afternoon, but Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines, once they've done their wise-ass exchange, having nailed Jimmy Smits on the elevator, it's cigarettes all around. Click, 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 and they walk out to the credits, puffing away. That's gone as well. That's only 1986.
I just love to see so-called professionals lighting up in places now where it's just laughable to even think about lighting up a cigarette or having a beer or anything like that.
People are just jumping on you. I think people are complaining today in the paper that Sigourney Weaver is smoking a cigarette in Avatar in 3D. It's even more threatening because, you know, it looks more attractive.
Practically burns your nose.
And so people are going, you know, it's in a fictional world set in the future. Very poor.
Thank you for your contribution. I think we've almost got our topic phrase right. We're looking for out-of-date movie moments that wouldn't stand up now. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My name's Graham, rather than me. But
hello, Graham.
What have you spotted, Graham?
I've got a slight variation on the theme.
Yes.
Year predictions that completely miss the mark.
Oh, yeah.
Space 1999.
Yeah, Space 1999, a futuristic show set in the past.
Yes. 2001, you know, just not there.
No.
Not quite. Not that we know of. 1984, I guess totalitarianism had a reasonable head of steam up by then.
Yeah, I was going to include that, but I think we were there almost.
Did we have two-way televisions? Did we have video phones then, like Big Brother looking at you?
No, but we did have manufactured wars and constantly changing enemies.
Oh, yes. So.
And what about they've taken a punt with 2012, haven't they?
Well, I like how little in the distance they've gone with 2012.
Almost there. And then the other one is, this is the reverse. You know, you've got mail.
Yes.
That was actually based on two movies from, like, the 20s and the 30s, one with Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, The Shop Around the Corner.
And remember they had that weird currency because it was hungry, so it was like dinars or...
Right.
But that was based on two mail deliveries a day.
That whole
movie was based on that technology that no longer exists, so they had to warp it into email.
Yeah.
There's a twist for
which
you.
Which has got me thinking, is there any Milkman movies?
The Milkman Rings Twice? No.
The Milkman Always Rings Twice.
There was Milk Money with Melody Griffith, sadly.
Well, that's right.
Milkman, there probably was Milkman movies.
I'm a bit worried now with, after, you know, erections on field, where you two are going to take this. We, as listeners, could be very worried.
Yeah, it's worth being concerned. Thank you, Graham.
Thanks, mate.
Let's try this person. Hello, who are we speaking to? Hello?
Who's that?
Oh, we've lost him. That's it. That's it. We haven't got a lot of technology or out-of-date moments to deal with, Tone.
No. Well, what do you have queued up for us music-wise, Tony?
I have American music.
Let's hear
by
it.
The Violent Femmes. Thank you for that promotion. Viva Wisconsin was the album. The artist, The Violent Femmes, or is it just Violent Femmes, and the track American Music?
Yeah, I think there's no the.
I don't think there is.
It's like Fantastic Mr. Fox. No the on there.
Never was.
No.
Even on the book.
I like to think that it's a film about Charlie Fox.
I love that book.
Our Sydney listeners.
Is it...
Americanized? Yes, it is.
One X or two in the spelling of Fox?
It's one X. It's not like John Fox, formerly of Ultravox.
Right. Great double X moments. Max Barry.
He
wrote the book Jennifer Government.
Is he a double X?
In his first book. This is a great moment of a subtle marketing joke that kind of went wrong.
Right.
Because Max Barry is now one of Australia's most successful authors.
That's
he writes
right.
mainly corporate satires.
Lives right here in Melbourne.
And his first book was Syrup, and it was about the cola wars and a particular recipe that sort of becomes a hot property. But he released that because he was making fun of marketing departments. He put on a second X into Max to become double X to kind of, you know, find that edge that they might try and, you know, in a blue cloud session, they might come up with a blue sky session.
Yeah,
they
might come cloud, up with, I like it.
They might come up with the idea of a double X.
But then he stuck
but
with
then
it.
He's writing his second book and goes, shit, am I going to go through life with two X's?
That's right.
And now he gets lost in the National Library as just having two novels instead of three because Syrup is published under Max Barry.
Right. See, this is like I was watching last night a documentary about John Garfield, the actor. His name was Jules Garfinkel.
What?
And he was told Garfinkel, too Jewish. So he became Jules Garfield. And then they went, still too Jewish, John Garfield. I'd like to think people will change their names to sound more Jewish from now on. I'd like to be Garfinkel.
We had a call during the tracks from Tony Biggs on The Blower, Fridays 9 till 12. Biggsy is on air at the moment.
Fine show.
And he has identified that all American movies, you can tell it's an American movie, because there will be a fight, an argument during the movie about who's in charge.
That's pretty much any American TV show. any American conversation, really, contains that element.
Charles in Charge, though, you just put it straight out there in the title.
I wish we had that theme song to go to. We've had a caller waiting for time through our drivel.
Oh, we absolutely have. We're still on the topic, if you want to call up. Henry did, during the songs, of talking about, I guess, outdated moments that you'll find in old movies. The one that got us thinking about it was the Filofax, which you won't find anymore, taking care of business. But Henry, you've got one for us?
Yeah, pretty sure it was a Disney movie called Daryl, and it was an android kid who was an absolute gun on the Atari 2600.
That's right, Daryl. It's one word, but with I think asterisks, MASH style between all the letters, which are in caps. And in fact, directed by our own Simon Windsor, the Australian director of Farlap and Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Ah,
yeah.
Well, there'd be a
and another movie. I'm not sure when it was actually based. Mm. But Back to the Future 2 with the hoverboards.
Hoverboards, right. So this is more things.
I'm not sure what year that was actually set in, though.
Right, well, okay.
I think the 2020s, wasn't it?
So you're suggesting we may have already passed the hoverboard era.
And not got it.
Yeah. It's not one of the most memorable movies that's, you know, had much of an impact on me, but I just remember it.
I love it as the greatest example of gambling plots that don't quite work, because Biff makes his fortune gambling with an old racing almanac. But the way totes work, there has to always... You can't have someone who can win on every race, I don't think. You need to also lose in order to...
But once you start getting into the logic
of totalizers
of Back to the Future 2, you start to go.
I'm sure you're putting a lot more thought than the script writers did.
Well, thank you for that, Henry.
Yeah. It's very hard because you go, but hang on, if he could have gone, why wouldn't he have? You know, it's very confusing about changing the future at the end of that film.
Exactly. Mm,
but it's a good suggestion. Old-fashioned, Commodore 64-style computer graphic. And that's what, in fact, that was one of the things that got me in Capturing the Freebans. And I'm sorry to go back to a documentary about pedophilia again. But you're meant to be watching this film and being suitably horrified by the sorts of activities that that he was. I almost want to say alleged, because he was certainly a pedophile.
Yeah.
Whether he did the things that he was eventually convicted of, I thought was a very interesting question.
Yeah.
But there was one scene where they showed one of the computer games that he was showing the kids in his computer game. It was in his computer class, and it was a penis, right?
Oh.
With a hand on it.
Okay.
But the thing that you should be suitably shocked as you see,
unless
the
it was
vision.
Unless it was a footballing context, but
one of the things that came out of it for me, that's a very unfortunate choice of words, but the computer, the level of graphic was so... almost, Pac-Man-ish.
Yeah.
That's what I went. I looked at it and I should have been horrified. I went, oh, that's a poor graphic.
So the kids weren't as traumatised as they might have been.
No, I really...
If the graphics had been more up to date.
I really wish I hadn't have brought up this whole topic.
Yeah, and I'm now feeling bad because I compared my family to Capturing the Freemans, forgetting about the pedophilia
aspect. Well, they would never have used...
That wasn't what I meant.
These graphics were poor.
Yeah. What I was referring to was just the fact that matters from a long time ago have been remembered and come back in extraordinary detail.
What was it Bigsy said again? Let's talk about that.
Well, I tell you what, while we're talking 80s movies, we've had a request. We don't often do requests here on The Two Tones, but somebody wants to hear the theme from Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs. Can we oblige, Tony? That's No Through Road from Adelaide with Party to Survive here on The Two Tones, filling in for the Banana Lounge broadcasters on Triple R, Tony Martin and Tony Wilson. We've been talking about things that you, don't see in movies anymore. Quite a few calls, excellent calls. Trying to think, I had a few more of those. I'm looking in the paper, Tony. I thought, I'll find something in the paper for us to talk about.
Yeah.
And I've been distracted by something I've never seen before in the Confidential, and it's an article about Kathy Lett, and there's not a single pun. There's no reference. She's not asking anyone to girlcott male authors. She's not referring to herself as a master of tongue foo. There are no jokes about Wonder Bras or Botox. I mean, what's happened? Is there something wrong with Kathy Lent, perhaps?
Well, it's certainly a genre. Do you think she was a pioneer in the genre? It's certainly alive and kicking, her type of book.
You mean books like Fetal Attraction or Alter Ego?
Yeah.
I've set myself a challenge once to think of a good Kathy Lent book title. And this is awful, but this is the best one I could come up with. Maternal Combustion. That sounds like one of hers, doesn't it? Yeah. It's a challenge. Come up with your own one.
Yeah, 93881027 if you've got a good Kathy Lett female related book title pun.
Yeah, now we've look at this. We're 1:40 into the show, and books have, because normally books come up sooner than this. What are you reading at the moment, Tony?
Did I say I was reading The Tall Man last week?
The Chloe Hooper Tall Man.
Yes.
Such a good book, but you say you're having trouble with it.
I just had a bit of a hiatus as I read Golden Boy, which is the Kim Hughes story. He was a cricket captain during the 80s.
Oh.
Hated by his teammates. You'd quite like it for the internal machinations in a strife-torn side. You would like it.
Really? So what goes on?
Like Dennis Lilly. You love him for his carpet call ads.
Commercials, yeah.
He tried to knock Kim Hughes' head off in the nets every time he bowled to him. There's an etiquette in the nets where you bowl well, but you don't try and bowl short balls into the batsman's head.
But why was he so hated that people would try to decapitate him at practice?
I think he talked about himself in the third person a lot and said how good he was.
That'll do it.
Kim Hughes is going to be the best batsman out there today.
Fantastic.
I think that is one of the reasons. But he was also not part of the club. There was a club of kind of established players, and he came through the system as a bit of a young Turk, and he didn't go off to World Series cricket, which was the thing to do at the time if you were going to be in with Kerry Packer and that crowd.
Is he mentioned in that book that Ed Cavalier was always going on about by Tim Zura? I can't remember what it was called, but it was pretty funny with the name.
Something about Stumped, was it?
Probably.
It's certainly he may have been, because he actually comes from WA as Tim Zura did.
Okay, so you've put Tall Man aside for a bit of
Golden Boy. A bit like the tall man. It gets it's quite a sad grind, I found.
Oh yeah, it's not a cheery book, but it's riveting. I found suspenseful. Yeah. The scene where the police station is being attacked.
The Palm Island riot.
Where you're going, hang on, this is, you have to keep going, this is really happening, this is not a made-up scene. It's quite amazing.
Yeah.
And there's a bit towards the end where people in the general members of the general public in Queensland are canvassed on their attitudes to the Aboriginal population, and quite extraordinary comments printed.
Yeah,
in there. I don't want to repeat any of them, but they're as you would imagine.
And what have you been reading?
This is odd, because I found a battered yellowing, just to keep with our 80s movie theme. I found an old, stiff page copy of The Devil's Candy by Julie Salomon, which was a book about the making of the film of Bonfire of the Vanities.
The Tom Wolfe classic.
Yeah, and it's a riveting, even now, still a riveting read of just how every single thing you could do wrong on a movie was done by one group of people. And what you're constantly amazed by is that, it ended up in a book. You've got to admire Brian De Palma for going, nah, put it all in the book. I don't care how bad I look. And it's on every page, there's just something hilarious. There's Melanie Griffith only reading the pages of Tom Wolfe's book that she's in, for example. And Bruce Willis just with a team, a squadron of people whose only job is to make sure that the bald bit on the top of his head is not seen. So, more time was spent lighting the top of his head and painting it than was spent on anything else.
Well, we should go to IMDb and find the concession moment in Bruce Willis's career. When did those people become unemployed? Because he clearly hit the depilatory cream or the razor at some point. I mentioned that I saw Die Hard 2 this week. He's well and truly full-headed in that film.
And yet that's after Bonfire of the Vanities. Interesting. It's like Nicolas Cage, bald one minute, not the next. There's some very good Hollywood hair pieces out there.
In Adaptation, the Nicolas Cage film about where he plays the part of screenwriter Charlie Kaufman.
And then his fictional brother.
Yeah, Donald?
Donald Kaufman. I think he's credited as...
Yeah, that's funny. It's actually not a bad joke. That's written by Donald and Charlie Kaufman.
And I think that was read out at the Oscars because it was Oscar nominated. So that's not the only instance where a fictional person has been nominated for an Oscar. I think Roderick James, who edits a lot of the Coen Brothers movies, has been nominated, and he's not a real person at all either.
Is that just the Coen Brothers?
That's just them, just amusing themselves. It was, took several years before people realised.
So, that bald spot, I was wondering, because he's meant to be sort of a down and out, kind of socially awkward, not very attractive, full of self-loathing type guy.
Yeah.
Is that bald spot that both Donald and Charlie Kaufman have in that movie, being played by Nicolas Cage,
right?
Is that makeup bald or is that real bald?
I'm assuming it must be real, because I remember seeing photos of Nicolas Cage where he had virtually no hair. And I also heard people I know worked... What was the film he made out here? Not the last one, the one before. Ghost Rider.
Mm.
Someone told me that while he was making Ghost Rider, the film National Treasure came out, and his hair looked so ridiculous that he fired 17 members of his 20-man entourage. And I'm going, really? Was 17 solely in charge of hair?
Well, it sounds like there's people who do that full-time in Hollywood. If the Willis people were looking for a project after Willis went all bald, they would have had to shift to someone else who was still in the transition period. So they're the people who make bald spots disappear.
The other one is John Travolta. He's got a very unusual hair, and I heard that when he was on Rove that he came in the afternoon with a team of people, and that the entire makeup area of Rove was partitioned off. There were like armed guards on all doors.
So that the anecdotes didn't get out of how bald he is.
So the team could go to work on his hair. And there was a picture in Who magazine, a very reputable Who magazine a couple of years ago, where you could see sort of cheesecloth. So I think it's actually a complete wig that he's wearing.
With Nicolas Cage, I got the nickname Tinseltone on Breakfasters for being about 2.5 years behind the beat in Hollywood. But I heard a rumour that he is on bad times financially.
Yeah, no, he's apparently been bankrupt despite making continual action movies where he gets paid millions of dollars.
And is it true that Johnny Depp, because Nicolas Cage was important early on in his career in getting a part, and I think Johnny Depp is just getting paid $40 million for the latest Pirates of the Caribbean.
Is there another one, is there?
And
you're ahead now.
He is going to donate. He is going to get Nicolas Cage out of trouble as a thank you for how important Nicolas Cage was early in his career.
Wow. That's
a stat I heard.
That's amazing. I'll tell you another good... You want to hear another good Nicolas Cage story from Ghost Rider?
Yeah.
I know people who worked on that film. And at the end of a film, you'll have what's called the rap party.
Mm.
So it's a party to celebrate the fact that we've finished working our guts off for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yep.
So you have it at the end of the shoot.
Yeah.
That's normally when it happens, at the end of the shoot. So Nicolas Cage on Ghost Rider has announced, oh, I'd love to go to the rap party, but I'm finishing up the movie 2 weeks before the end of filming. Mm. And they're going, well, why don't you just come back and go to the rap party? He's going, no, that doesn't suit me. That's annoying. Why don't you have the rap party 2 weeks before the film ends? Which is, you know, that's not the done thing at all. So they did. They moved the rap party back to the second to last weekend.
And everyone drank orange juice because they had to work the next day.
And Nicolas Cage didn't show up. Didn't bother coming anyway.
So he's celebrity crazy.
He's mad. I think he is.
Right.
I did hear some story about some assistant having to fly his girlfriend's lipstick at enormous cost to an island off Fiji. There were a lot of stories like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, it's turning into the Tinseltone segment.
Yeah.
What music have you got for us now, Tone? Is there a link to what we've been talking about?
Yes, we were talking about movies that had a go at predicting the future. In fact, I'm not sure we were, but,
no.
But a caller rang up and I thought very informatively ran through a lot of year title films and books and assessed how well they'd gone at it. And given that we've just left the decade that never really got a good name behind and are now up to another decade that's still to get a good name, I thought I'd play a pulp track that that contemplates the future. Before that, we heard from Pulp and Disco 2000. I said it was their film about the future, their song about the future. Actually, yes. I meant their predicted future in the past.
And an animated Jarvis Cocker can be seen in Fantastic Mr. Fox singing a song, yes.
Good film.
I thought I liked it. I, it's not what a lot of people will be expecting, which is the reason it hasn't made any money.
Great book.
He's not interested in the sort of the normal beats of an animated film. There's not quite enough slapstick for the younger. Squeakquel fans will be disappointed. Let me put it that way.
And did you have a favourite baddie in it? Mr. Bunce?
Yeah,
Mr. Bean?
They had great voices, the bad guys. Michael Gambon was one of them.
Right.
Mm.
Well, also, thank you to Paul who called up and said that Pulp have never been properly picked up for taking or borrowing or not acknowledging Laura Branigan's Gloria at the start of that song.
Ah, right. Is that what
da-da-da. Da, 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 da.
Well,
hope you've got my number.
I'm sure. Hang on. is this your new single? Put it onto YouTube. And of course, earlier you played a Jonathan Richman song, which sounded exactly like the beginning of that. Sounded like, I think, something from The Strokes. I could be wrong.
That was the Something of Our Lives, the Morning of Our Lives.
We have someone on the line, however, because our show today has just descended into possibly defamatory stories about Nicolas Cage's behaviour on the set of the film Ghost Rider, shot here in Melbourne. Scott, are you there?
I am indeed, Tony.
You've got another one for us?
Well, yes, a friend of mine was working on Ghost Rider, and early on in the piece was given the dubious honour of partially looking after Mr. Coppola, as he was to be referred to.
Is that right? Is he?
Was Mr. Cage.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And on his rider, he insisted in quite specific terms on a black Range Rover with blacked-out windows, very specific chromed mag wheels, which at the end of the shoot was to be brought out to the States and was to remain in his possession.
Right, so this wasn't a prop for the movie.
No, no, no. This was his wheels, his ride in town.
Okay.
Which went on for quite some time, toing and froing as to all the details of it, with the guys involved constantly saying to his minders, you do realise it's going to be right-hand drive and not an awful lot used to him back in the States. do you want us to get a replica one made in the States for him? No, no, he just wants the fucking car.
Okay, really?
Well, that might be how he went broke. He had to transfer it from right-hand drive to left-hand drive and did his day like that, and now Johnny Depp's having to pick up the bill.
You just go, how does... I mean, this is a man who's, like, being paid $20 million a film and making about 7 films a year. They just... Every time you switch on your computer, there's trailers for, like, 3 or 4 more Nicolas Cage films with names like Bangkok Dangerous that you've never heard of or seen.
Yeah,
or wanted to. But allegedly, as well, there's quite possibly a fair bit of money has descended up his nose.
Oh, really? Of course, in the form of cough medicine and Vicks Vapor Rub.
That's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you, gentlemen.
For those tales of Mr. Coppola, almost time for us to sign off, Tony, here at, I guess it's the Two Tones, but certainly filling in for Banana Lounge Broadcasting.
It's been I turned myself off.
You have turned yourself. We need one to go out on. We need a technical issue
that
to
was
go
it.
Out on.
Tried to turn the phone down
now,
and turned the tone off.
We've got one more show to do next week, and by that time, will you have done your best man duties?
Yes, it's my brother's wedding this Saturday.
Wow.
So congratulations to Ned and Olivia. I presume you'll go through with it
and
not present us with some sort of Julia Roberts-esque plot line.
And have you, how did you go? We talked about it last week, fashioning that story into an anecdote about him driving through the swarm of bees.
Where he ducks his head under the dashboard and continues to drive, even though all the windows are up.
I haven't written
the speech yet.
Okay.
That one's being tossed up. We're also tossing up the day that he victoriously broke the wooden spoon. We used to get hit with a wooden spoon.
Really?
And Ned, it was Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead type stuff when the wooden spoon broke on Ned's backside. I'm going to try and work that one as well.
Fantastic. And, all the best to everyone involved, Ned and his bride-to-be. And, you know, let's hope the weekend is uneventful and that there's no burnt scrotums.
And we have Sister Bieber coming up now with The Good, The Dub and The Global. We've got one more week to go, as Tone mentioned, and we've actually got a guest next week. Daniel Kitson will join us for the second hour of Banana Land Broadcasting next week. So we look forward to that. See you later.
Bye.